the Manor Law Building. Welcome to the ESTER visiting lecture of the Department of Sociology of 2013. Our lecturer today is Professor Sam Bowles. Sam is a research professor at the Santa Fe Institute, where he directs the behavioral research and behavioral science program. Sam was trained as an economist, but I don't think he will mind if I said that he's a very unconventional economist. He has really wide-ranging research interests. Unlike some of us, well, me especially, you know, spending years tweaking our regression on our piddling research area, Sam's really asked big questions on a very wide canvas. He worked with anthropologists and archaeologists to look at the emergence and the development of inequality over a very, very long run. There was a special issue in the current anthropology, the journal, maybe 2 or 3 years back, on the mobility and inequality of four types of pre-modern societies. And he works with biologists on animal behavior, you know, dominance, cooperative behavior, and he also worked with theorists, historians, experimentalists on some of the on the development and evolution of some of the basic institution of our society, as well as some core social motivation like cooperation, altruism, and so on. So we are very pleased to welcome Sam to come to us today. He has written something like 20 books, like 12 of them are from 2000 and afterwards. So he's writing books faster than I can read them. I think this title actually is, the title of his talk is actually the title of his book, so maybe we get a preview of that particular book.
Thanks very much. Thanks for that generous introduction, and thank all of you for your interest in the work here. Actually, it's been a long time arranging this visit, and I greatly appreciate the welcome to Oxford University, which has a connection to my work that goes back more than a decade. I came here to give a very speculative paper to the zoology department. It was about a group selection model of human evolution. During that time, in conversations with Alan Grafton, I got a whole series of good ideas, which I later developed, and which have been important ever since. But even before that, Richard Dawkins' book, The Blind Watchmaker, gave me the idea that I should teach a microeconomic theory course in the PhD program where I was teaching, based on evolutionary thinking in, that one could actually apply across the disciplines. And of course, over the years, I've profited from many of you helping me with emails. I can see many of you with whom I've communicated. So thanks very much. It's a great pleasure to be here. I want to thank also my many co-authors. Aside from the fact that I don't sleep, I have a lot of co-authors, as you can see. And those particularly here are the ones with whom I've worked on the projects that I'll be describing. And this is the book, it's already out, and the what I'll be saying, talking here today about will be these papers, the basis of the work of these papers here. If we have time, I want to talk about this this last thing here. It's a population, it's a paper in population genetics, which, if we have time, I'll get to it. It's directly relevant to some of the debates and disputes in this area. Now, let's start with Dawkins, because that's in a sense where I started. Like successful Chicago gangsters, our genes have survived in some cases for millions of years in a highly competitive environment. This entitles us to expect certain qualities in our genes. The predominant quality being expected of a successful gene is ruthless selfishness. The gene selfishness will surely give rise to selfishness in individual behavior. I was recently in California, and I thought I had to, you know, sort of please the locals by showing them a picture of their former governor. I agree entirely with this Chicago gangsters analogy, but I want to raise some questions about the outlined stuff in red. I think it's a non sequitur. And I will attempt to show that the gene-centered view of the world does not lead you to this conclusion, but rather to a much more nuanced one. Now, so the question then is, if genes are selfish, how can seemingly generous behavior have become so common among humans? And by generous, I mean helping behaviors that are motivated either by a concern for others or perhaps by ethical motivations. Well, there's plenty of answers to that. Somebody may be looking, said H.L. Mencken. We have the great biologist, Alexander, talking about ethics, morality, human conduct, and the human psyche are all to be understood only if society is seen as collections of individuals seeking their own self-interest. Now notice, this is a phenotypic statement. We're not talking about selfish genes here. We're talking about the expression of this selfish gene in a selfish phenotype. Does anybody recognize this guy? He's an 8-year-old hall monitor in the school in Western China that collapsed during the earthquake there. And he first ran out, and then as the building was collapsing, he ran back into the building, and he hauled 2 injured kids out and as the building was collapsing. And somebody asked him afterwards, why did you do that? The building was collapsing. And he said simply, I'm a hall monitor. That was what he was supposed to do. Or the fireman, notice the fireman is going up the stairs in the World Trade Center while a few people are going down. Now, these people are strikingly unself-interested, probably not seeking to establish reputations, probably not being afraid that somebody is looking. Or consider a subject dear to my heart. This is a picture of people voting for the first time in Johannesburg. Why would they vote? They can't conceivably think they're going to affect the outcome of the election, not any one of them. So their voting itself must be taken as some kind of generous or moral act. So we have selfish genes and a lot of evidence for unselfish people. And so we have, at least in the literature, a sense that we have some kind of train wreck. And I'd like to try to resolve that. Now, I've found that biologists are more fractious discipline than most, and they argue a lot about words. I'd like to tell you how I'm going to use the words that are used here. They're all quite standard, because I don't want to be talking about semantics. I want to be talking about substance. By cooperation, I mean simply participating with others in a common project that yields mutual benefits. Now, that need not be altruistic. It could be mutualistic. For example, a market exchange, according to me, would be a form of cooperation because it yields mutual benefits. Altruism, by contrast, is behavior benefiting others at a cost to oneself. And that is, one would then have, for example, higher fitness or higher material payoffs if one ceased doing that activity and did something else. Now, we immediately are confronted, if we have these definitions, with the Mother Teresa problem. Economists often have difficulty with Mother Teresa because she obviously got a real kick out of helping the kids, right? So are we to say that Mother Teresa was therefore self-interested? No, I think we have to treat Mother Teresa as a biologist would, which is Mother Teresa was engaging a lot of energy and giving up material well-being in order that she could help these kids. This leads, therefore, to a careful definition of what we must mean by preferences when we're talking in economics, which is preferences are evaluations of states which our actions may bring about. That's what they are. And therefore, the word self-interest or self-regarding preferences are preferences that consider only the states that occur to the active, whereas other regarding preferences are preferences which consider states happening to other people. So I prefer these other regarding and self-regarding definition as opposed to selfish and so on, because obviously with the Mother Teresa problem, the reason why we have this problem is you might be fooled into thinking that the only kind of altruistic behavior is counter-preferential, that people could never want to perform an altruistic act. And we want to avoid that, obviously, because when we talk about altruism, we talk about people who are voluntarily helping others. She'll return later in this thing. Now, what we want to explain is the emergence and proliferation of a kind of cooperation that is distinctly human among the animals, and that is the pursuit of common projects with large numbers of individuals beyond the immediate family. Large numbers of people beyond the immediate family. We're not talking about helping offspring or siblings. We're talking about very large numbers, assembling sometimes, you know, dozens, sometimes hundreds of people with whom one engages in an activity without sometimes even knowing the individuals or certainly not being closely related to them. There are lots of models that can explain this. I'm sure you share my frustration. It seems that every time you open a page of PNAS or Nature, you'll find yet another model explaining the evolution of altruism. And of course, they're all mathematically coherent, or most of them are. They all provide insights about some processes which may have been at work, which may explain this rather unusual animal that we have become. I think by now the price of these models should have gone close to zero because there's so many of them. I think there's a different question, which is which of these various models might explain how the human species evolved under the conditions we are likely to have experienced during the late Pleistocene and early Holocene. So it's an empirical question. That's a group of hunters, Hadza hunters, with whom I actually hunted, not those particular guys. To any Buddhist here, I want you to know that I didn't catch anything, and neither did my friends. To those of you who are interested in evolutionary biology, this may help. It's how I see the field. This is, of course, J.B.S. Haldane. We start with Darwin on social behavior, and there are two branches which are quite distinct in a way which I'll make clear in just a minute. But first, let's see what we have. Here we have reciprocal altruism, mutualistic cooperation, and then we have these various models. The game repetition is one way that you can have mutualistic cooperation, signaling, reputation, indirect reciprocity, and so on. These are all part of this branch here because these are all self-interested cooperation that is mutualistic. On this side over here, we have inclusive fitness. Fisher, Hamilton 64, Haldane actually said a lot of what's in Hamilton a little earlier, get the idea. And then you have these various forms of expressions of inclusive fitness. By kin-based altruism, I mean altruism towards close family members. Others have suggested a broader definition, but I'll use the narrower one for reasons which I'll explain in a minute. Group-based altruism, based on group competition. There's a network version of that due to Novak and others. The crucial thing here is that these are altruistic. These explain why people would help others at a cost to themselves. And these are over here the ones explaining why you're helping somebody because somebody may be looking or because you have a long time horizon or something of the kind. And the important thing, difference between the two, is that for altruism in this branch to develop, what all of these models do here is there are ways in which it will be the case that an individual who has a hypothetical altruistic allele will benefit from the help of others more than it would occur by chance. So there's some kind of non-randomness. It's not necessarily genetic non-randomness. It isn't that I have to be paired with another person with a similar allele as long as for whatever reason I get help from the individual. It's usually expressed as a genetic correlation, and it's not important that whether we distinguish, for what I'm now going to say, it's not important whether we distinguish because I won't be talking about contingent strategies. That's for this thing about whether the person is genetically helping you or just happens to help you for some other reason. But the important point here is that some kind of positive assortment whereby the altruist benefits from being more likely to get help from others than would occur by chance. That's crucial. Over here, no such mechanism is required. By the way, if you have questions, ask away. I expect there'll be, this is a lecture which is, it's organized so as to raise large questions. You may have large questions for me. I'll put off large questions till the end. I promise you I'll finish and there'll be at least half an hour for us to discuss. But if you have difficulty or with something I've said, and you don't understand what I've said or term, by all means ask and I'll try to answer it. Now, we'd like to explain why self-regarding people, this task, explaining why self-regarding people would contribute to the public good, it's a puzzle. It's a puzzle that's occupied a lot of game theorists and biologists and so on. This is the kind of thing which this whole part over here, the previous graph, is designed to answer. Why it is that people help, repeated games and so on. If you think instead that there's a lot of generosity in humans, there's a lot of generosity in some humans in some circumstances, they willingly and enthusiastically help each other in some circumstances, then it's not so puzzling explaining why it is that people would cooperate. But the puzzle then is to explain how this species could have evolved such that it had a substantial distribution of people who were predisposed to act altruistically. So the problem at the top here is some clever game theoretic argument about why selfish people would cooperate. And here we now have a problem about how is it that natural selection could produce an individual who genuinely is altruistic. Now, you say, well, why do I think it's genetic? I don't know if it's genetic or not. What I do know, I'm pretty sure, is that the arguments about how it couldn't be genetic are false. And that's what I intend to convince you of. Not that there is a genetic basis for altruism, but that the arguments that there could not be, because natural selection would prevent it, are not correct. This issue, of course, has been debated a lot. Kropotkin famously explained that humans and many other animals are committed to mutual aid. Thomas Huxley opposed Kropotkin, saying that nature was red in tooth and claw. Of course, it wasn't he who said that, but he quoted it widely. Darwin said something which is neither Kropotkin nor Huxley. Selfish and contentious people will not cohere, and without coherence, nothing can be affected. A tribe possessing a greater number of courageous, sympathetic, and faithful members who are always ready to warn each other of danger, to aid and defend each other, would spread and be victorious over other tribes. Thus, the social and moral qualities would tend slowly to advance and be diffused throughout the world. There's the red and tooth and claw part of the story here. That is, the tribes would be victorious over other tribes. But it's explaining how it is that these moral facilities, the faculties of helping others and so on, would proliferate. And so the hypothesis I want to put before you is that we may engage in mutual aid because evolution is red and tooth and claw. In other words, both of the guys, this guy had it right that there is a competitive, violent, and aspect of evolution that Darwin has mentioned here, but it could lead in some situations to a species which was committed to mutual aid. That's the basic idea. So more about words, because I want to red and tooth and claw nature, does it preclude mutual aid? Well, let's think about this. Selfish genes. What do we mean when we say genes are selfish? Well, technically what we mean is they obey what's called in mathematics a replicator dynamic. And what that means is that an allele that is making that has a higher fitness than average will tend to grow in the population. It's a very simple concept. That is, it's monotone in fitness. That's all it means that the gene is selfish. Biological altruism, as I've said, is helping others at a cost to yourself. Altruistic preferences can be self-regarding or ethical. I don't have to care about you in order to help you. I may help you because I'm constituting myself as a helping kind of a person. This is the question: are these altruistic preferences doomed by natural selection? And I've already said this. I don't think that the answer is that altruistic preferences, genetically, an expression of a genetic makeup of humans, is doomed by natural selection. But we have absolutely no evidence that humans are genetically altruistic either. I think we soon will, and I would not be at all surprised if we had positive evidence within a decade or so. Now, what is a possible way in which humans could have become genetically committed to behaving altruistically? Well, there are two parts of it. We then, as now, lived in environments in which cooperation among large numbers of people is extremely beneficial or essential to survival in such things as predation, risk pooling, and so on. It was a large mammal-rich environment in the African savanna, very volatile climatic conditions. All of these things make cooperation essential. That, of course, doesn't explain how it could evolve, because if cooperation is altruistic, it should have been disadvantaged in natural selection, at least within groups. But altruism was essential to cooperation within groups, and those with a preponderance of cooperators, altruistic cooperators, did well in competition with other groups. This is the hypothesis. And if that's the case, then you have these two sides of the story. One is group with lots of altruists winning against groups with few altruists, and at the same time, within every group, the altruists are going to be losing to any defectors or non-altruists who are in the group. So you can just see there's an equation with two terms with opposite signs, and so we're going to try to look and see which of these things is likely to be more powerful, or the conditions under which the between group aspect, which could favor altruism, could be strong enough so that we could have become an altruistic species. Now, I want to stress that whether or not this story is true, it's an empirical question. We're talking about something that happened, and we're trying to explain why it happened. So we're not talking about which model is better than that model on some other grounds. We're just trying to say we want an explanation of something that happened in the real world. Let's talk about the terms kin selection and group selection. I've already said that altruism can evolve only under this condition. Hamilton's rule expresses this, where the benefit is B, cost of the action is C, and R is the relatedness between the helper and the helpee. Now, that's a general expression which says that there's something about population structure expressed in the R which gives you the non-random pairing of individuals, helpers and helpees, that's going to explain how it is that altruism can evolve. Hamilton said if this is true, an altruistic allele could spread. It's critical now to look at the R. R is assortment. R says you're more likely to interact with people who are like you or act like you. And so I go to Cavalli, Sforza, and Eschel, very nice paper, in which they talk about all the different reasons why populations are not fully mixed or randomly paired, but rather are structured in such a way that people of one type interact more with people of the same type. Kin, deem, niche, social group structure, neighborhood effect, idiosyncratic behavior, discrimination in the choice of companions are some of the possible sources of deviation from randomness. Now think about the process. These different aspects of non-randomness, they may imply, if our altruistic predispositions come from different kinds of non-randomness, we might also expect that their proximate expression would also differ. So for example, suppose the non-randomness in pairing has to do with children and family relatives that don't disperse. They all stay in one place, so we're interacting with only family members. Then we'd expect that the kind of sentiments which we'd have, which lead us to be altruistic, would be towards things like siblings and parents and kids and so on. Whereas if the story is that we have this positive assortment because we have small groups which become different genetically by chance, that's called genetic drift, because they're small, if that's the reason why, then we should have some kind of group loyalties, and it wouldn't be parental or offspring or whatever. It would be generated by the same kind of Hamilton's rule-like process, but it would lead us to perhaps act more on things like nationalism or religious intolerance or something of the kind. All of these things. things will use an expression like that. I'll show you the expression for the group selection model, which I use in just a minute. Despite the fact that they all use an expression like this, I think it's useful to distinguish between kin selection based on interactions between close family members and group selection, which doesn't rely on close family members, but rather some other kind of assortment based on small groups. And so that's why I want to keep track of these different levels of different reasons for the assortment. Now, I think enough on that. I mentioned this because those of you who are in biology know there's a big dust-up going on among biologists. And this is my advice. Huxley, as you probably know, was called Darwin's bulldog because he was so pugnacious. And I found a beautiful letter that he wrote to a young man in his later years. This is Huxley saying, I wish you would let an old man who has had his share of fighting remind you that battles, like hypotheses, are not to be multiplied beyond necessity. Here's Darwin's logic. Here's how the Darwinian story works about the tribes and so on. The black dots are altruists, and then they play cooperate. The open dots play defect. It's a prisoner's dilemma game. And here they're paired. They interact. Then they have some payoffs. Then there's a new generation which is in proportion to the payoffs. And the black guys didn't do as well as the white guys, so now there are fewer altruists. Then we have some immigration. Then this group meets some other group. In my work, both the mathematics and the simulations, you just randomly chosen. It could be from a network or spatial array. This group and that group are then going to compete with each other. This group has more altruists, therefore it has more cooperators, therefore it has more people willing to do battle against the other group. It wins. This group is, we can say, eliminated, but all that matters is that it's reproductively disadvantaged. But let's say they're eliminated. This group takes over that site, grows to double its size, and then because these are all pre-state, obviously, it can't exist and govern itself in this large size. It splits randomly. And so now you get two groups, and then these groups then go on and you go back to the top. And that just goes on and on. But notice, we started with four altruists here, and we ended up with five in this group. Ended up with only three there, right? So this is the randomness in the splitting of the populations is what gives you the possibility that despite the fact that in every group the number of altruists will be declining, or at least not increasing. Because of these, what Haldane called tribe splitting, he actually used the expression, because of the tribe splitting, you can get, by chance, these groups that have more. If you say to yourself, gosh, did that make all that difference? That's what I said when I read Haldane. I thought, would that really make that big a difference? Well, when I simulated this, I found that it does make a big difference, and I should have said, well, of course it makes a difference, because we're talking about very small groups. And because we're talking about very small groups, the randomness of how a group splits will give you this very frequently, this kind of thing. Now, of course, the way groups really split, we know from studying Amazonian fissions and other fissions, where they really split is they split by lineages. So the amount of differences which are created by the splitting should be much more than random, because whole families go off or coalitions go off and so on. They split because of ungovernability problems. They get infused. So the basic idea is that this within-group selection against the altruists could be offset by this process here of the elimination of a group with many defectors and its substitution by two groups with a substantial number, but one group which has really got a lot of altruists. And that's how it works. That's why I think Haldane is a genius. Figured that out in 1931. I'm indebted to Alan Graffin for pointing me to the tribe splitting. That was really important for me to figuring out how this thing could work and why it's not so much of a stretch. But if you look at this, we really want to now ask, are there some things that could make this process go faster or slower. Or there's some things that could make this process go faster or slower. And for example, think about this. Suppose groups meet and have these contests once every generation. And this process here, of course, happens once every generation. Well, that's one scenario. But suppose that group competition happens twice in a generation, or it happens maybe once every 7 generations. Well, obviously, if it happens once every 7 generations, this process here, which could lead to the altruists growing in the population, will be relatively weaker than if it happens very frequently. So we're now going to, I'll now suggest to you 5 ways in which human society in the Pleistocene probably was such that this process here could have been attenuated or retarded, while this process here could have been accelerated or strengthened. And that's this. Here are the things that humans do very well, which would lead to the attenuation of within group selection against the altruists and the enhancement of the force of group selection between group selection. Group boundary maintenance. Humans are very good at doing that, and we have very substantial group differences because of essentially our ability, as Cavalli-Sforza and Eschel put it, to discriminate. Frequent lethal competition among groups. High levels of mortality in these contests. This is what's called reproductive leveling. Humans engage in practices at the level of the phenotype that lead to the minimizing of the variance of reproductive success within a group. And that's why things like sharing food or monogamy, so that somebody who is stronger, for example, doesn't get all the food or all of the copulations. Rather, these things are more evenly shared in the group because of marital practices, which are monogamous, or because of food sharing practices, which are substantial, and so on. So these things here will enhance the between group selection. This one here slows down the within-group selection. We also, for completeness, I've added this. Humans are very good at low-cost punishment of transgressors because of our linguistic capacities, our ability to use projectile weapons, and so on. And finally, we have the capacity to internalize social norms. These also, I think, are part of the actual story of how humans became a cooperative species. But I'll only focus on the first three, that is, in the mathematics and the simulations. I just take account of the between-group differences, between-group hostilities, and within-group reproductive leveling. I essentially put those into a standard individual-based model of natural selection, and then we see what happens. This is a summary, I put it all on one slide just so you'll know. I couldn't possibly think I'm going to put this on the test or anything like that. But to give you an idea of how the model works, we have a group-structured population. We have some vertically transmitted trait. It can be vertically transmitted from parent to child anyway, but I'll say it's genetically transmitted. The sites on which these groups live, they limit how many people can live there. So there's no way that a group can grow in the population except by getting another site, getting another place to live. This, by the way, is a very strong assumption that works against my model, because it means that a standard way in group selection models, like the models going back to Sewell Wright in biology, is that a group which is successful will send out more migrants than others because they'll just produce more kids. That's not possible here. You can only grow your population if you get another place, another site. This so-called Price equation, named after George Price, is at the top. This just expresses the change of the fraction of the population that is altruistic as the sum of two terms, and this term here has to do with the between group aspect, and the second term with the summation sign has to do with the within group aspect. What's crucial here to look at is this. This is the between-group variance of groups indexed by J. So how different are the groups one from the other? So take the means of the groups and express that as a variance over the whole population. The second term is the within-group variance. This term here is how bad it is for your fitness if you're an altruist. That term there is how good it is for the members of your group if there are a lot of altruists in your group. It was George Price's genius and great gift to biology that he showed that you could write down on some simplifying assumptions this expression here. So we have the change in the population is just this two additive terms. It's a very neat decomposition. Now, I say stationarity. Suppose we want to look at the condition for P to be stationary, or for delta P to be zero. Well, obviously, for delta P to be zero, this term has to be equal in magnitude in absolute magnitude to that term, and we can write this down and end up with an expression which is right here at the bottom. I won't go through, I think all this would be a distraction, but this is the expression that you get if you want to get altruism neither growing nor declining, not being eliminated by natural selection. It's a very simple derivation, and I'll tell you what it means. This is the cost of the altruistic act. This is the amount of reproductive leveling. I'm going to try to measure all these things. This is the degree to which groups are different genetically. This is the between group variance. This is the benefit to having a lot of altruists in your group. Let's look at that. With probability kappa per generation, your group engages in a contest with a randomly selected other group. Kappa will be some number like 0.2 or 0.1 or something like that. So every five generations or something, you engage in this conflict. Lambda sub alpha sub A is, this is the derivative of your success probability with respect to how many altruists you have. So this is how important it is in winning the contest that you've got a lot of altruists. That 2 is there because if you win the battle, you double your reproduction. Remember, the group that won took over the other side. So that's the effect of winning. So this is the probability that this thing happens in a generation times how good it is to have altruists in your group for winning times what you get if you win. Now, I'm going to first notice this is exactly Hamilton's rule. This is the benefit. This thing is the R, and that's the cost. What this says, if groups are different enough, and the other terms here are as they are, well then, altruism can proliferate. And you can see right away that here, reproductive leveling has the effect of reducing the cost of the altruism because essentially you're sharing a lot of goods. Now the problem is, how do you actually implement a model like this empirically? And that's what I'll turn to. The idea behind the dynamics of this model is that we have two processes, one genetic and one cultural. The genetic process is all about individuals. And everything genetic in the process is about individuals. This is what you might call an individual-based natural selection model. There are groups, however, and the group competition obviously favors groups with lots of altruists. But therefore, it's going to also favor groups who have institutions which tend to preserve a lot of altruists. So suppose there are two groups, and one has food sharing and the other doesn't. The food-sharing one has reduced the rate at which the non-altruists are taking over. So at any moment in time, if they started out with the same number of altruists, later on, in three or four generations later, the group that has food-sharing is more likely to have retained more altruists. And should they then have a conflict with others, they're more likely to win. And that is how food-sharing could spread. Now, these institutions like food-sharing or other forms of reproductive leveling, these are conventions in the game theoretic sense, that is, they're mutual best responses. And the important thing is they don't themselves require altruistic preferences. It's just a mutual, if everybody else is sharing food, it's not in your interest to refuse. If everybody else is monogamous, it's not in your interest to try to have more than one mate and so on. So we have culturally transmitted institutions at the group level providing an environment which affects genetic evolution. This is, of course, a classic case of niche construction, as it's called in biology. And this is culturally transmitted niches. Whether or not this framework works depends on a whole series of data, which is what I will now turn to. These are the sites in which I got genetic data, reproductive leveling data, warfare data, And let's see the kinds of things we'd need to look at. We'd like to establish to what extent do groups differ in their genetic composition. We'd like to look to see if the fitness disadvantage of altruists within a group would not be too great because of reproductive leveling. We'd like to ask whether or not we have differential survival of groups which have a lot of altruists because of their success in competition with other groups. Now, when I say competition with other groups, I'll be talking about warfare, and because that's something on which we have some data. Competition with other groups, the two groups side by side in that picture, it could be just that you're facing a very volatile environment, and the groups that cooperate are more likely to survive than the groups that aren't, without any warfare between them. It would make no difference at all in the model, and I'll come back to that. If you know, one could ask, could this process have worked without warfare? Their answer is yes, but I don't think it did, but and I'll tell you why. So the FST, that's from Sewell Wright, is a measure of genetic variance between groups. We have tau, a measure of reproductive leveling. That's the fraction of food that's shared. We have kappa, the frequency of intergroup lethal conflict, and we have N, group size. And those are the things that really matter. In the equations that I put before you, I had assumed infinite group size, which is, again, extremely unfavorable assumption for my working of the model. But group size actually will make a difference. That's Sewell Wright on the left, and his companion, you can see. He wouldn't go to lecture without a guinea pig, I guess. He's one of my heroes. But I was surprised when I read him saying that he thought the FST among humans was something like 0.02. Now remember, 0.02 plays a role in the price equation, like relatedness. That would mean that human groups were basically identical. It would mean that the between means differences in groups was only 2% of the total variance. I collected data from these populations. In some cases, I calculated the FSTs myself from the actual genetic markers. In some cases, I took data which was published. And as you can see, these numbers are quite varied, but they're large. They're four times larger than what Sewell Wright had imagined. And I've done quite a bit more work on this data set since then. Interestingly, these particular numbers don't change. The father and the son there are from the Akka people in Africa, with whom some of the early genetic work was done by Kabbalah Schwartz. Let's think about reproductive leveling. Okay, so the conclusion from this is there's a modest level of between group variance, much larger than George Williams or Sewell Wright or most biologists would think for most animals. Reproductive leveling. I model reproductive leveling as a flat tax, just a percentage tax on the stuff that you get, you acquire, that goes into the common pot, and then we take lump sum out of the common pot equally. It's sort of a standard move in economics. So the stuff that you keep yourself is the stuff you take home, and the stuff that's taxed goes into the pot, and you get your share out of it. Of course, that's not the mechanism by which food sharing takes place. It takes place in networks and so on, but I think we'd like something like this to look at the genetic effects of reproductive leveling. Well, we have just an immense amount of information about food sharing among foragers, partly because of the work of Jim Hill and Hilly Kaplan, and many others, Mike Gervin in particular, since then. You can see that there's a substantial amount of sharing. It's really quite remarkable. 77% of the food by caloric value was transferred from the person who acquired it to a person who was not his or her immediate family. So, that's a gigantic amount of redistribution. Here you have the Lamellera. They're whale hunting people, and these are the divisions in which the whale is made. These all go to various parts of the society. One of my students asked if the whales are really that color. For the forager groups that have reasonably good data, including the Hiwi and the Aceh and one other, I calculated the tau of about 2/3. There are other forms of reproductive leveling on which I couldn't get any measures, so I just had to set that aside. And here's a as an example of the kind of result that you would get. The question is, how large could an altruistic trait, how costly could an altruistic trait be and nonetheless survive? And now, to give you some idea of what selection coefficients are like, a cost of 0.02 would be regarded as being a very bad thing to have. I mean, if an allele which had a cost of 0.02, a fitness cost of 0.02, would be eliminated from a population in a matter of generations. Selection coefficients in this range here are considered to be large, except for a few things like lethal illnesses and so on, which have larger selection coefficients. What the graph says is, if warfare is this frequent, how costly could it be, given that equation there? Anything above the line means that altruism could survive, could grow. And anything above the line means altruism will grow. Things on the line means it's stationary. So this is the stationarity condition from that equation there. And what you can see from this is that suppose warfare happened, every 7 generations, I guess, that would be, then there would be a whole range of, you could have altruism of a very costly kind surviving. We need to ask, however, was warfare frequent enough? That was my next project. What do we know about the frequency of warfare? What is the likely frequency of warfare during the Pleistocene? Now, the evidence for this is of two kinds. There's ethnographic evidence from hunter-gatherer populations, and there is also archaeological evidence. I'd be happy to talk about the details. They have to do with essentially examining skeletons and asking whether you think this person died in a conflict with an external group. These are better because they are counts. This particular individual here had 19 arrow points embedded in his bones. That's typically what we look at in these data here, is embedded points. We probably miss a lot of war deaths because most people in war don't die from things being embedded in their bones. We happen to know that by some U.S. Army doctor who actually studied why people died when the U.S. Army was fighting a Native American people. You find out wonderful things when you pursue far enough an agenda like why people die when they're attacked by people who are using arrows. These are the results, and what I found was the mean of the archaeological and the ethnographic data is 0.14. That's a miracle, of course. It just means that, you know, that turns out to be a very substantial amount of mortality, and obviously certainly enough for the group selection process that I outlined to be a powerful force. I love the northern part of Australia because it's kind of the best laboratory we have of hunter-gatherers surviving right up to the almost, you know, well, just a few centuries ago. But I'll pass by these to get on to question of frequency of warfare. Now, it's not enough to say that we had frequent wars, obviously. We'd have to ask, why would a species evolve such that it had frequent wars? Because the people fighting the wars are, after all, dying in these wars. And the people staying home and saying, well, after you, are the ones who would survive. So that engaging in the warfare and being hostile towards outsiders is itself not a trait which you would expect natural selection to favor. So Jung-Kyu Choi and I developed a model in which there are two loci, and there are two alleles at each loci. One is altruism as opposed to not, and the other is tolerant of outsiders versus parochial, is the word we used. So there are four types in the population, and we're interested in what happens to the altruistic and parochial types. That is, the ones who don't like outsiders, but they do help insiders, and because they don't like outsiders, they get a lot of good wars going. And because they're also altruistic, there's plenty of people who will fight them. So that's the process, that's the evolutionary process we're trying to uncover now that we see some evidence that there was a lot of lethal warfare in the distant past. The dark line here is the fraction in the population of parochial altruists. This is a simulation. And it's based on an evolutionary game model. There are a bunch of results of a theoretical nature, but the main oomph in the paper comes from this. So here, these are generations. There's very few Barroca altars in the population. This initial upsurge happens by chance. At that point here, this is the frequency of warfare, and it goes from very infrequent, once every 20 generations, to about as frequent as we've observed in the data, about, and then it fluctuates. So this is the outbreak of war and Barroca altars. This simulation here, these are the same simulations, are an outbreak of peace. Again, stochastically, you'll have a decline, and then there's nobody who's willing to fight. And the groups that have people who are willing to fight don't have altars, so they lose. And so you have a peaceful period. So that these are long periods of history. This is an attempt to capture what happens in the very long period, over millions of simulations, and also millions of years. Here we have no altruists, and we have no parochials. And over here we have all altruists and all parochials. The height of the skyscraper is the fraction of time that the population spends with this distribution. So we're looking at a system that's moving around this state space. And as you can see, there are two. The population spends all of its time in two places. Tolerant, selfish individuals here, and altruistic parochials over here. And we see occasional movements across this saddle.
I think, because I didn't tell you about Australia, I think I have time to try me. Oh dear. All right. They said I shouldn't do that. Now, I'm going to run this. I'm going to run this just for a minute. I can tell you what's going on. This is the same graph you just saw. These are no altruists and no parochials. Each dot is where the population is in that time period. Up here is the parochial altruist, but there's nobody there. Here we have, these are the parochial altruists. Here are very few of them. These are the altruists, and these are the parochials. So what we're going to do is we're going to look at this graph here. It's called, mathematically, the stationary distribution of the dynamical system, which we outlined. And we're interested in looking at its properties. That's a what's called a perturbed Markov process. We can't analyze it analytically, but we can try to what's called recover the hidden Markov process in this kind of simulation. And I'm going to put it on slow, but you'll see it's not very slow.
Now, the thing, now, it just made a transition. So it made a transition from the the selfish, tolerant group over here to the, and now it made another transition. One thing to notice about this is these transitions, the system is very mobile. It covers a lot of space. So when you see something that's called an equilibrium, so you're talking about a stochastic process like this, it can be moving all over the place. I'll have to stop it because you won't be able to see anything anymore. What a
simulation like this does is
it allows us to look not only at where a population is likely to spend most of its time, but we can also, from this process, derive the vectors. But if it's here, where is it likely to go next period? And I won't show you that, however.
Something is not. This could be just the end of the talk.
All right, so we've done the outbreak of war and so on. So this is the summary. That's me and my grandchildren. And I'm embarrassed to say I'm wearing the same shirt that I was wearing at Christmas time. I really do have another one. Let's think about other animals. We have evidence from chimps that we have quite differentiated communities of chimps. That is, the FSTs among chimps are not very different from humans. They're not less. We have males who patrol cooperatively. We're not closely related.
They could be staying home and either mate guarding or exploiting the fact that the other males are absent. There are between group conflicts and with very important fitness effects, that is territorial losses and deaths. But by the way, the death frequency among chimp so-called wars or conflicts is not very different from the estimates I have for humans. We even have reproductive leveling, not so much in chimps, but in baboons, where groups of subordinates will gang up on a dominant male who's mate guarding, and they almost always win. There are many other animals have conflicts, like, you know, a lot of insects have conflict, meerkats, and so on. So the question is, humans are not unique in having group conflicts and having genetic differentiation, and even in having a little bit of reproductive leveling here. So then the obvious question is, why did humans turn out differently? I don't have a good answer to that, but I don't think it's a really hard question, because I think the reproductive leveling is really important. We do a lot of that, and we communicate that by language and social norms and so on. I think that's really an important part of the picture. But it's an interesting question about whether this model or this explanation could explain some of the cooperative behaviors of other animals. But remember, you kind of hope it doesn't, because the amount of cooperation among, say, chimps or baboons and so on is really very limited compared to humans for the reasons that I mentioned. A few speculations and conclusions. This is just a summary of what I've done. I won't repeat that. It's important to stress that the parochial nature of our altruism, the kind of conflicts and sometimes intolerance towards outsiders, it may be, and I think it is the case, that this is part of our genetic legacy, but it's obviously not necessarily part of our destiny. That is, we're the ultimate cultural animal, and we don't have to live by the same standards that we lived in the distant past. It's a choice. The other processes which I mentioned at the beginning, of course, were operative. Reciprocal altruism, kin selection, and so on. The argument that group selection was involved doesn't obviously mean the other things didn't work. It's just that the group sizes of individuals, the individual groups during the Holocene, during the Pleistocene, make it rather unlikely. And I won't now talk about the research I've done on group size, but I think the evidence is quite overwhelming that it's just an illusion to think that we lived in very small groups of close family members in the past. I don't think we did. And I'll end with, this is Plassey's River Mouth in the Indian Ocean coast of South Africa, where 90,000 years ago, modern humans, biologically modern humans, were hunting very large animals. We're decorating themselves using ochre. We're engaging in all kinds of what are called modern behaviors. Not only classic river mouth, but there's the modernity of some of the southern African sites is really striking. Something really dramatic happened 50 or 60,000 years ago, which is a group of humans, probably quite small, left Africa, and then went incredibly rapidly to Australia. I mean, getting there within 10 or 15,000 years. It took a little longer to get to Europe. Now, that's just an extraordinary event in human history. And why did it happen? Well, obviously, anybody who wants to speculate, it's good for after-dinner conversations or for when you're a second-year university student, you talk about big, big questions like this about which it's hard to have an answer. One of the things people talk about, well, there must have been some genetic innovation that gave them something that gave them the edge. Well, all of the things that have been suggested are, happened, hundreds of thousands or millions of years earlier, having to do with the reorganization of the throat and cranial changes and so on. So there's likely not to be the genetic silver bullet. There's probably something behavioral. And it's possible that what the diaspora from Africa was facilitated by was the fact that a group, maybe as it was once thought in the Upper Rift Valley, maybe as now more often thought in southern Africa, maybe some group there mastered how to cooperate with each other in opposition to other groups. And maybe that's what gave them the edge, and maybe that explains why they, rather than somebody else, are the ancestors of all of us. The last thing is something I'd like to just remind you of. Suppose what I've said is true. Suppose you're convinced that there's a substantial and possibly genetically based predisposition to act generously or ethically within human populations. How would public policy be different if you thought that? Now, before you think that's a rather arcane question, remember that the tradition of public policy, writing constitutions and making public policy, since Machiavelli, and certainly with Hobbes and Locke, and the economic paradigm from Mandeville to Adam Smith and up to modern mechanism design, it all shares the same paradigm, which is assume everyone is selfish and design a constitution for a population like that. Now, people I mentioned didn't do that because they thought that empirically people were selfish, all of them. They did it on prudential grounds. We want to do it because we have to have essentially a jerks-proof constitution. Now, the problem is this. We now know that if people are predisposed to do the right thing, very often treating them as if they're not actually has destructive effects. And so public policy, this is not a little wrinkle. This is challenging the tradition from Machiavelli right up, how about this, from Machiavelli to Maskin. I hope you all know who Eric Maskin is. He's one of the primo mechanism design people in the world, and a friend, by the way. I wasn't kind of the other guy I mentioned. This is my next book. I always write the cover before I write the book, because I get discouraged in writing. Here's the basic idea. It was Machiavelli who said we should, he was the first person who said, very articulately in the discourses, he said, we should not base good government on having good citizens. We should base good government on laws which induce citizens who of normal humors, as he called it, to behave as if they were good. Well, I think that's a real challenge, and I would welcome any help in this project. It says 1914, but to tell you a little story, I began this project. First time I wrote this thing was in 1989, and I've been working on it and with various degrees of discouragement and encouragement ever since. I think now the evidence is overwhelming that I'm onto something, but I'd be very happy to have comments and so on. You can read a paper that Sandra Polania and I wrote in the Journal of Economic Literature if you want to sort of see what we're thinking and then maybe try to help out. Thanks very much.
Selection. And Richard said that it gave him an allergic reaction. So I don't know if Richard's here or anyone is itchy, want to ask about group selections or anything which come up on top.
No. Thanks a lot for the talk, Sam.
Yeah.
Pretty interesting. I've got two questions, both about relation to the assumption of the model you presented about halfway through. So if possible, could you go back to this slide of the mathematical model? The first question is in regard to reproductive leveling. In my undergraduate dissertation, I looked at the evidence that our ancestors were monogamous as opposed to polygynous. My conclusion was that we were probably weakly polygynous based on a number of kinds of evidence. Most importantly, genetic evidence, which people have looked at the ratio of the variance on different chromosomes relative to the predictions under monogamy, i.e. one-to-one sex ratio, and found significant deviations in the direction predicted by polygamy. So I wonder if you could talk about how those kind of findings relate to your assumption of reasonable or high reproductive leveling. And in the second place...
Wait, can I answer that?
Sure, yeah.
I welcome your second question. All the argument really needs is that we're more monogamous than chimps or bonobos. Okay. I'm not saying that monogamy, you know, there's a different question you could have asked about monogamy, which is monogamy will reduce the variance of male reproductive success, but it will increase the variance of female reproductive success. So it's not obvious exactly how monogamy works here. I mean, you've thought about it a lot, but what's really important is that monogamy essentially is a way of reducing the variance in success among males, but it doesn't do it for females. It increases the variance of reproductive success among females because there's some females who are the sole wife of the really
good guy, right? Now in the Politician Society, he might have two or three, and so all of whom would do better than they would with, you know, being paired and mating with the weakest. So the argument about, first, this is food and not polygyny or polygamy or monogamy. I didn't use that, and in part because I haven't worked out exactly how it works because of the difference between the two sexes. The evidence about polygyny among hunter-gatherers, which I'm sure you know well, is that it's not, people say polygyny is common among hunter-gatherers. What it means is it's common that it's okay to be polygynous among hunter-gatherers. Polygyny is very rare among hunter-gatherers. It's very rare. It's just that it's okay. There's nothing against it. It's not until you get to horticultural societies that you get a significant amount of polygyny. But what's important here is that the single pair bonding and monogamous mating of humans was didn't have to be perfect. It could be a fair amount of polygyny. It could be, say, 10% or 20% of the women married polygynously. That would still make it a very monogamous animal compared to our common ancestors.
So just very quickly answer the second question. The second question is regarding the basic assumption of the model that you have this process of fissioning that's kind of ongoing. What's the justification for that assumption? Why couldn't it be the case that certain groups sometimes just get very large and there might be, in some cases, returns to scale due to ingenuity or innovation or something like that, which would impede the fissioning process? Or make groups so large that within groups, forces opposing out altruism would tend to predominate.
They would make, I'm going to complete your sentence in a slightly different way, would make groups so large that even when they did fission, the differences which were generated by the randomness of the fissioning wouldn't be great.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
It's like a, you know, it's like sampling theory. The argument is if the groups were large enough, then when they split, even when they split, you wouldn't get very big differences, because what you're getting the big differences from is the same thing, same reason that you get differences in sample means are very large if the samples are small. That's a very good question, particularly because the part I didn't say is that I think that the idea that the groups were very small is probably false. I think there's genetic evidence for that. So that fissioning process is what produces the genetic differences between groups. I'm not using the fissioning process to derive the genetic information. I just look at the genetic information. That is, the FSTs come from evidence. So whatever produced them, possibly without getting much of the separating because of randomness, that could happen. For example, the Amazonian fission that I mentioned, there are two of them, most of the genetic differences between the groups had to do with non-random separation of the groups and not with their small size. I'll show you that reference. It's very interesting that you can calculate if you have groups of a certain size and they separate randomly, how different should they be, the two so-called daughter groups? And they're just much, much more different than that. So what that means is people were leaving in segments. And that'll give you a lot of separation, even if groups are large. The last question is, why couldn't groups get very large? Well, groups couldn't get very large because there's no government. I mean, these are all consensual decision making. These are acephalous, meaning headless societies without chiefs. And so it's very difficult to govern a group more than about 50 or 60 that way without, I mean, 50 or 60 would be maybe 30 adults or 30, you know, it's very difficult apparently. How do we know that? Because we don't see very, very large groups of acephalous societies. Sorry, could you
say that again? You mentioned that you thought that the ancestral kinship is largely
equal.
Yeah. But then you said that the groups are beginning to work.
Yeah, that's much larger than what people say. People say a few dozens. If we have time, let's take a few more questions. If we have time, I'd like to address that, both because it's new work and I'm interested in your reactions. Quite speculative, but I think groups were probably more than the size of, you know, 90 or something like that, which raised the force of the previous question that Noah asked. So I'll come back to that if possible.
Just to preface it, I'm an evolutionary biologist who has been critical of some of the parts.
No! How could it be?
And I'd like to take issue with the way that you've used Hamilton's rule in this model, because so Hamilton's rule is overall lifetime fitness consequences of the behaviour for the individual. And the way that you've calculated the C and V terms here aren't the way that you're calculating for Hamilton's rule. So the way you're defining altruism is not based on Hamilton's rule, it's based on your own definition. So I'm wondering for this model actually whether you're looking at the evolution of an altruistic behaviour as Hamilton's rule defined it, or whether actually it'd probably be mutually beneficial, because here it's a behaviour that you're performing some interaction within your group, but actually it's directly benefiting you because it means that the group you're in is more likely to survive.
No. That, I'm sure you didn't mean to say that. If everybody else went to war in your group and you stayed home, you'd do better. Because they'd die in the war.
Oh, but that's not how it is in your model. In your model, it is that if you perform this behavior, the group that you're in is more likely to survive, and then your offspring are more likely to survive.
Yes, but by not, unless the group is very small, that effect will be very small. And the main effect will be you won't bear the cost of the altruism. You don't pay to see. You avoid the cost of participating in the battle, and your group wins anyway.
But connected to that, so you've assumed in this model that the behavior is only possibly altruistic, that it's a positive behavior, but I would suggest that any behavior, you've assumed basically cooperation exists at the start of your model and then shown that it can spread, or altruism exists and it can spread because of group competition.
No, that's a game.
I reckon a behavior that actually has a cost to you and to your within your group could still evolve, because it's being driven by the benefits and the fact that any behavior that makes your group do better is more likely to spread. So all group competition does is kind of turn up the intensity of selection of what's going on within your group.
If there were no group benefits, it couldn't evolve. And the individual who engages in the warfare would do better if he or she stayed home. So what you said is wrong. That is, you don't understand what I said. Now, I understand that you're critical of my work, but at least criticize my work. That isn't what I said. In the model, the person who stays home does better, and they benefit because their group wins. Their contribution to their group winning could be large if the group is very small, and then we would be on the same page. But that's the only condition under which it would be true. And I didn't assume altruism to begin with. I said, suppose there were an altruistic allele. Could it proliferate in this population? That's the way everybody reasons. You don't say, you say, suppose there's an allele that commits you to do B to somebody you're related to by R, and it costs you C. And you then try all kinds of, continuous variation of that. Well, I think that's the way to do biology. I don't think you disagree. Of course, you have to invent an allele, and you say, could it evolve? But it doesn't mean I'm making it happen. It could have failed. And you can see in the equation, it can certainly fail, and you can see all the regions of the parameter values in which it fails.
Sure. The way you've calculated B and C there is not how a biologist would do.
Well, I think it's exactly the way Aoki did, and also Marcus Feldman. They're very good biologists, and Mark knows this work very well. I just think you must be understanding something about this that's not there. Because an issue about lifetime, these are all generational. This is all lifetime.
So, one in
light
blue,
and
then.
Sam, I'd like to come back to sex group. You talked a lot about warfare as a mechanism for cooperation and competition, but you didn't mention cooperative raids on other groups for access to sexually reproductive females, which has been observed, I know, in a number of hunter-gatherer societies, also some other primates. Have you looked at that as a mechanism? Presumably, if it's significant, it would strengthen
Well, it certainly happens. I mean, we don't know how frequently it happens in the Pleistocene, obviously. But there's an interesting surprise in the evolutionary model, which is, suppose there's a group that has the military power to take over some other group, and to either eliminate them, or to eliminate the men, and then have sex with the women, say, rape the women. Which of those two things will spread their genes faster? raping the women or killing women? Killing women. Why is that? Because if you're raping the women of the group you beat, they're genetically dissimilar from you. And therefore, the children of those matings are not going to be as similar to the victors as it would be if you had the excess reproductive capacity within the group. Essentially producing children with people who are of the other group who you beat because they were genetically different from you by hypothesis is not a way of spreading the gene. As long as you have the site-specific reproductive limits that I mentioned, which is you have to have a group, but you have to have a site. If you have the site, and if you can double your reproductive success, you're obviously better doubling it with this sort of homegrown reproduction than mixing with the outside groups. We did exactly what you said in the simulation with Choi. This is a two locus model, and we tried an alternative in which instead of killing everybody, you just killed the males and then you had extra females. And it's quite a bit harder for the parochial alpha traits to spread. Not impossible.
My question was actually. That now, based on what you said, I'm just thinking, so you are saying if I have a wife at home and I don't take part in this ready, I don't benefit by reproducing with these extra women that are available. I mean, that's a pretty unlikely assumption because the women are limited in how many children they can have. It's not a case of, like, well, can I have six with my wife or three with me?
No, but I mean,
I could have six and six.
If this model were not restricted to a particular site, if this were not a site-specific reproductive model, which, as I say, I chose because it's a very hard model to get group selection to work in, that's why I chose it, and that's why what I just said to Eric works. If it's not site-specific, then having extra women, because you obviously can have as many kids as you want, because there's no limitation on the site, then the limitation is the reproductive capacity of the women. And then you're right. So, in other words, sorry, my answer to you, Eric, was based on this rather stringent assumption that members within a group are competing for reproductive success, as in the models, you probably know the models of Taylor, for example, and others which do that. And I think a more like a Sewell-Wright model would be more like what you're saying, what Eric said. Can I talk about group size? I want to talk about whatever you want to talk about.
Just a quick question. So I can see the advantages in a between group conflict, perhaps with more altruists in one group versus the other. But also within the group, the altruists may have advantages in coping with external shocks, natural disaster, drought, scarcity of animals, hunt and gather. Is that within group altruist benefit? And I haven't looked at the model. Is that enough to account for the results without any of the military conflicts?
Well, we don't know because we don't. But what we know is the Pleistocene climate was extremely volatile, which led to a lot of migrations and probably led to a lot of conflicts, but also led to a lot of groups going under. We know population crashes are very common during the Pleistocene. There's a lot of evidence for that. So that being the case, it's pretty reasonable to think that groups that cooperated would do better in those environmental crises, unless the environmental crisis was really severe, in which case then the groups who were non-cooperative would do better because some people would die and a few would survive. So the cooperative solution can work because of environmental shocks and without group conflict. So when somebody says, was warfare necessary for the evolution of human altruistic cooperative behavior, I say no, any kind of group competition will do. But I think on the evidence that I've given you, I don't think that's what happened. I think what happened is there were frequent group conflicts, which were lethal, and that was part of the story. They may have been augmented by these environmental things, which we can't measure. Because we can measure, broken ulnas and smashed foreheads and things like that, so we can get a pretty good idea. People with multiple wounds and so on in the front rather than the back, you can sort of figure out a little bit about the prevalence of lethal warfare. We don't know why groups fail to survive the environmental crises. They just die.
Just a corollary on the mortality from violence. Can you pinpoint the conflicts within the group that led to violent deaths from those that were between groups?
You can in some cases. There are two kinds of things you can do. In the archaeological evidence, for example,
there are some very clear pieces of evidence. I mean, typically, people killed within groups are killed by ambushing them from behind. So you don't have the broken left ulna and the forehead and so on, the back, cranial things, and of that nature. Secondly, in the archaeological evidence, you have entire missing limbs, like trophies taken. That's probably not just that angry of your neighbor. You know, if you have, you know, five men who are missing their right arm, well, it's pretty clear that they lost the war in their area. In the ethnographic evidence, of course, we can distinguish. No, I shouldn't say of course. In the ethnographic evidence, there's some debate about whether I'm feuding with your group, and is this a group warfare, or actually are you my in-law, and we've got some group thing going. So, but in general, I mean, there are some groups, for example, that have the Murrngin in Australia, that they have a very large number of words for the type of the conflict, exactly what was the nature of the conflict. So we can identify with them, among whom 21% of the deaths were from warfare. We can identify those really were intergroup warfare. Now, the rest of it is, you know, there's a huge variance around these estimates. And I just, I'm happy to say that it doesn't matter very much because the kinds of evidence that we have about the genetic differences and the warfare and so on are sufficient to suggest that group selection could have been a powerful influence during the places.
This one at the back.
Yeah. So you're arguing that athletes could have the genetic basis.
Could have, yes.
Yeah, could have. So I was thinking, would evidence, I guess an implication of that would be that people who have this gene tend to behave altruistically, no matter in which social context.
Not necessarily. You could have an altruistic allele that committed you to behave altruistically unconditionally under all conditions. You could have that.
So that would be my question. So there's overwhelming evidence, some evidence, at least in the behavioral economics literature, real social preferences change a lot depending on how you frame the games,
I was wondering. Well, for example, people respond to the price of altruism. And there are a number of papers, I'm sure you're familiar with them, one by John Miller, which demonstrates that people vary the amount they're willing to give drugs according to the price they give drugs. And I think that's the basis for thinking that people have a taste for helping others like they have a taste for ice cream. If I tell you that we're genetically predisposed to like ice cream, the sweetness of it, it's not evidence against that to say that you'll consume less ice cream if it costs $50 a cone anymore. And in the same way, the fact that I like to help other people and I'll help them less if it costs me more is not evidence against altruism. It's just evidence that altruism is not something sui generis. It's another kind of thing we may enjoy doing or may want to do, which is like eating ice cream, and that therefore is responsive to training and price and so on. The fact that training is involved in, you know, people think of altruism as being something, I don't know, descended from on high or something spiritual or whatever. I prefer the ice cream theory. It's just something we enjoy doing, and the price matters, and the training matters.
So we have three more questions, one here, one at the back, and then please.
Quite convinced about why we should or we would adopt the unit of group selection theory. So I can see now how it explains.
Sorry, you said, what exactly did you say? Why would you say the unit?
Why we would adopt group selection as a unit of evolution of altruistic traits.
Okay.
I can see how it explains that, but I don't see why we would need it as opposed to a gene level selection.
As I said, I endorse the gene level thing. And the work of Choi and Gina. So the group is not the unit of selection. What's the unit of selection in most of what I was talking about is the individual. Individuals produce a lot of kids, or they don't produce a lot of kids. Groups are not equal. There's a problem with the language. We have individual selection, we have gene selection, we have group selection. Reasonably enough, people think that group selection must mean the groups are the units that are being selected. That's a problem with language. My models are either individual-based or gene-based, and I absolutely agree with Dawkins that we can do a fully reductionist view. There are some views of group selection in which one assumes or shows that the unit, the group, has itself become a unit of selection because competition within the group has been eliminated.
multicellular organisms, for example, that whatever that organism is, it becomes the group, and then there's selection market. But I don't presume anything like that. That's what, for example, E.O. Wilson calls a superorganism. The superorganism is something within which there is no selection happening. And I think, you know, if you assume that, or if you think that's the way the world works, well, clearly the group selection model will work because there's nothing else going on. But I don't think, you know, human societies are not like that. We're competitive societies. We have heterogeneous groups within. And I think, I mean, all of my models, the altruists are doing poorly compared to the individuals who are not. So that process is always going on. And that's the way it works. The way it works is that individuals in groups, which have a lot of altruists, those individuals do well. I mean, George Williams, I imagine you're familiar with his work, George Williams, in his big critique of group selection, he said a fleet herd of deer is a herd of fleet deer. Right? The adjective to the group means it's a bunch of deer who are fast. There's no such thing as a fleet herd. And I absolutely agree with George Williams about that. I mean, I think he was arguing against the view of group selection, which had to do with exactly the thing you were concerned about, which is the group itself is the unit. It's possible, but it's not necessary. I think extremely unlikely.
Please.
Yeah, I'm a sociologist, so genetic things slightly out of my field. But I guess one thing that keeps bugging me is are there sort of is there a sort of counterfactual circumstance in the sense that, like, and maybe this is too old for it to actually be useful, but are there groups that wouldn't have had the right circumstances to develop altruism, and if those groups still exist, can we find them and as such kind of prove the opposite of the hypothesis? You know, if the circumstances did not obtain, therefore, look, here's our group of non-altruists. Obviously, that's quite a difficult thing to determine.
No, I think it's an excellent question. I mean, what the model that I outlined and the data and the calibration model say is that it allows you to say that if the parameters were different from this, right, here's how different they would have to be, then it wouldn't work. Now, that doesn't mean that if you find a group today which doesn't have reproductive leveling or that hasn't had a war in seven generations, that group should be selfish. Because we're explaining the evolution of human genetic makeup over a very long period of time. But if I were to find, for example, that any evidence, for example, that the genetic differences between groups during the Pleistocene was very small, as Sewell Reitman's thought, because of, say, extensive migration or gene flow between groups, I would have to say all bets are off. It's probably wrong. And that's the kind of evidence. There are things which would falsify it, but of course, it's hard to get that evidence to the Pleistocene in the same way that it's hard for me to get evidence that I can really say I'm convinced of about the Pleistocene. All I can say is, it looks, you know, there are large error bars, but if you add it all together, unless you take all the worst error bars, it works.
Last question, go to Bolton.
Thank you. A lot of your arguments, or a large part of your writing book is fueled by evidence from laboratory experiments. So I was wondering in how far laboratory experiments can help us to make inferences about models of separate and discriminate genomes. I was wondering what your opinion is.
I don't think laboratory experiments can say very much about evolution at all. For me, I mean, I hardly mentioned maybe one word about laboratory experiments in the whole talk. As far as I'm concerned, the evidence for humans being generous and ethical is all around us. I gave you some examples. We don't need experiments to tell us that people are sometimes very generous, often bearing huge costs on behalf of others. I think the experiments are very valuable pieces of evidence about the conditions under which people act generously and so on, and I've benefited very hugely from this two decades of experimental research. But to me, people sometimes try to use experiments to test evolutionary hypotheses. I think it can be done. I've seen a couple of papers that I think did it persuasively. But remember, the point is not to use the experiment to try to explain evolution. The point is to try these evolutionary models to answer the puzzle about how a species could have evolved that behaves that way in experiments, or behaves that way when the World Trade Tower is coming down, or behaves that way when your school collapsed, and so on. So I think using the experiments as a lens for evolutionary thinking is really the wrong tool. I mean, you know, we need prehistory, archaeology, genetics, evolutionary modeling to understand those questions. And so I may be wrong. I may be too down on that. But people often ask, well, why don't you test this experimentally? And I can't think how to do it.
Okay, before we disperse, I'd like to make two announcements. First is that I like to think that we are non-parochial altruists. So everyone will be invited to join us for a drink next door, and you can chat with Sam in a more informal setting and, you know, mingle with other people. And the other thing is that there are three more seminars in sociology coming up in the next few days, really. So Frank Carter from Mannheim will be talking about ethnic inequality and social integration in Latvia at 5 p.m. Tomorrow. And then on Thursday, Daniel Lichter from Cornell will be talking about America's ethnic future and the emerging patterns of residential segregation. And then about 2 weeks from now, on Wednesday, 20th of March, Randall Collins from UPenn we'll be talking about solving the Mona Lisa smile and other developments of micro-sociology. So they all seem a really interesting and fascinating talk, and I encourage you to go to these seminars. So before we disperse, let us thank Sam for a really